This is Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick's Church. We're doing our fifth series on the third commandment of Moses, given on Mount Sinai by God to this outstanding leader of the Jewish people, some thousand years before the coming of Jesus. And the third commandment, of course, is keep holy the Sabbath day. And then we add, so the Sabbath day can keep us holy, whole, and wholesome. I'm talking with my guest, Ron Eldred, who is a professor at John Paul II Catholic High in world history and in religion. And Ron has a wonderful Catholic background. He's a convert himself of many years and has assiduously studied the Catholic faith before he came in and after he came into the church. So Ron, welcome once again. We were discussing in our last, we've had four sessions on Keep Holy the Lord's Day, Third Commandment, and we were talking about why there was such a fallout in mass attendance, not only in the United States, but around the world, since Vatican Council II, and some of the great fundamental reasons that seemed to cause that, and one being a loss of belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. So I think we were talking about Father John Hardin, who was a great theologian and a great catechist, as you said, maybe one of the greatest in the country, who had taught dogmatic theology in seminaries for over 20 or more years, and who gave endless conferences across the United States before his death in somewhere around 2000.
Wrote lots of books, catechisms, articles, hundreds of articles on the subject, a renowned authority.
All right. And he says some very startling things, and I think the one thing that made me stand up and listen was that he said Pope John Paul II had asked him, with his theological background, his catechetical ability, to do anything possible to help restore loss of faith in the Eucharistic presence, real presence of Christ, in our country. In the United States, because otherwise Pope John Paul II feared that we would continue to slip into the quicksand of just kind of ignorance of the most central doctrine of our faith, the mystery of faith.
He was actually afraid, the Pope was, of losing dioceses in the United States. I remember back a number of years ago, a bishop in a particular diocese polled his priest if they would go with him if he left the Catholic Church.
Oh,
so
really?
It's not, so there's
a
foundation to that belief on the part of John Paul.
So last time we were talking about that famous chapter of John called the Eucharistic chapter, where Jesus talks about, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood.
Yes, John 6.
John 6, cannot have life everlasting. So why don't we continue with the Holy Father's statement, Pope Paul VI, Mysterium Fidei, or the encyclical Mystery of Faith, that he wrote right in the middle of the Council, 1962 to 1965.
Well, of course, Pope Paul VI was concerned.
Did I say John Paul? Yeah. Pope Paul VI, excuse me.
Some of the things that have been introduced in the Council, and they were debating at that time, concern Paul, dealing with the liturgy, that if these innovations were made, the church would have to be very careful that it properly prepared the laity for these changes, and that certainly it had to really emphasize the importance of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist.
As the fundamental anchor,
yes,
of the whole church's teaching.
Yes. And so then Father Hardin goes on here to quote lengthy parts of this encyclical. And what we're going to talk here about is the part where Paul VI identifies what he thinks is the main reason for all of this.
Okay.
This loss of
faith
in the real presence. And Father Hardin tells us that Pope Paul VI uses two words to summarize the Eucharistic crisis. and they are the heirs of transignification and transfinalization.
Okay, now this is distinction to what the church has always taught since the Council of Trent about transubstantiation. So I'd ask our listeners not to be frightened by those words, because they're not as awful as they seem to be, and we'll talk about the meaning of transignification and transfinalization and then transubstantiation. And
keeping in mind now, this is the Pope himself thought that this was the main reason for the declining belief in the real presence in the Eucharist.
Okay. So what does transignification mean?
Well, this view means that when the consecration at Mass is performed, only a change of meaning or significance, a change of significance of the bread and wine takes place. Their substances do not change. And by substances, we mean what it's made up of.
What makes bread bread, yeah, and wine wine.
Right. Okay. And the view is contrary to the Catholic view of transubstantiation. You have, of course, you can see the word trans in there, which from the Latin or Greek would have to do with a cross or change or something of that sort. Okay. You can see the word substance in there. And so we're really talking about substance or something that's made up of something.
And going from one thing to another.
Yes, so it's a going from one thing to another. This is why Thomas Aquinas, I think he's the one who adopted this word, if I recall right, originally in his great Summa. But this
that's way back in the 13th century.
That's back in the 13th century.
Okay.
Which states that at the words of consecration, the substances of bread and wine are literally transformed into the substances of the body and blood of Christ. Let me repeat that. Which states, this doctrine of transubstantiation states that at the words of consecration, that is, this is my body, this is my blood, that the substances of the bread and wine are literally transformed into the substances of the body and blood of Christ. Now, in transignification, the consecrated elements are said to signify all that Christians associate with the Last Supper, that when the priest says, this is my body and this is my blood, there is no transformation. The meaning changes. The significance changes. Okay. So that's why it's called transignification.
We see it in the context of the Last Supper, Jesus saying, love one another, the new commandment. He washed the feet of the apostles,
yes,
and he gave the new commandment, and he wanted this to, anytime this, these words of consecration were said, were to remind people of the sacredness,
yes,
of this Last Supper.
Yeah, and that's why we say that the consecrated elements are said to signify all that Christians associate with the Last Supper. But there's no change.
All right.
It's still bread and wine when you get through. But okay, the meaning of it changes. The significance, okay, of it changes.
It's very subtle, but real.
Oh, very subtle. That's why people don't quite, you know, most people, unless they really study this kind of thing, really don't see a whole lot of difference sometimes, when there is a world of difference.
Okay.
But the idea is that the bread and wine acquire a higher meaning,
okay,
than merely food for the body. But they still remain just bread and wine. That's the thing to remember. It still remains bread and wine. So to repeat again, the meaning of the bread and wine changes, but not the matter or the substance.
Okay. And these are really philosophical terms that the church has always used,
yes,
in trying to clarify what Jesus meant when he talked about at the Last Supper. This is my body. This is my blood. Okay.
Father Hardin quotes Karl Rahner, who was one of the famous theologians back in the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And Karl Rahner says, quote, becomes the dwelling place and the symbol of Christ, who is present and gives himself to his own. Father Hardin says that through various theologians such as Rahner, the idea of transignification has permeated the Eucharistic theology of whole nations. The theory of transignification was condemned by Paul VI in this encyclical that we were talking about, Mysterium Fidei, in 1965, if it's understood to as denying the doctrine of transubstantiation.
And which it does seem to do.
Certainly.
Even though it's a very subtle difference, but profound difference when we see what traditionally the church has always taught from the beginning to the very present time.
What it amounts to is that after the consecration, in the case of transubstantiation, that the substances truly become Christ's body and blood. While on the other hand, in transignification, after the words of consecration, it remains bread and wine, but the significance or the meaning changes. These theologians didn't go and, you know, talk to the laity or anything of that sort. Most of the priests who believe this, and I've come across a lot of priests over the years that basically held more to this view than they did the transubstantiation. They don't go out and talk about transignification or transfinalization to their congregations.
Sure.
But I've even read that if a priest doesn't really believe that the specie or the bread and wine are being transformed in the body and blood of Christ, he doesn't, in other words, have the intention of the church, mm-hmm. then is it a valid Mass? Is it a valid Eucharist?
Okay, I sure want to steer away from that topic.
But it's a question, you know.
That
would make you, and somebody, like Father Hardin himself has raised that question.
Father Hardin was very, very deep into this.
Yes.
And then he was also talking about the other, quoting John Paul, Pope John Paul VI encyclical on the mystery of faith, what was called transfinalization. And it's a little hard for me, honestly, Ron, to see a whole lot of difference between transignification and transfinalization, but obviously there is a subtle difference.
It's so subtle that I did quite a bit of reading trying to find any real clear distinction, and even Father Hardin says that it's not really cut and dry, you know, in terms of any real distinction. But basically, let's give it a try here and see if we can. The view means that the purpose or finality, this is where we get the transfinalization, of Christ's presence in the Eucharist is changed by the words of consecration. But what remains after the consecration, though, still just bread and wine, like in the case of transignification. In other words, the bread and wine now serve a new function as sacred elements that arouse the faith of the people in Christ's redemptive love, but it's still just bread and wine, but it's final purposes, I guess this is where they get this transfinalization idea, has changed or been transformed. And as one can readily see, the meaning of these two terms are very similar, except that in each case, the bread and wine still remain bread and wine after the consecration. So I guess that's all.
That's
really
the bottom line.
That's the bottom line, yes.
Okay.
That there's no change in the substance. The man, the theologian that was most associated with this was Edward Schielebeeks. He was a Dutch.
From Holland.
Holland, a Dutch theologian. And he was the leading proponent of transfinalization.
Okay. Well, so Pope Paul VI, writing this encyclical, was foreseeing that there's some real questionable statements about what we believe that can be very confusing, particularly to ordinary people, that we have to be really careful to use the ancient words that the church has used down through the centuries, such as transubstantiation, although it's a big word, to clearly defend the mystery of faith. That we're again at the heart of the church is belief, and that Pope Paul VI wrote a whole encyclical trying to say, now we have to be really careful that we don't lose the baby with as we change the bathwater.
Well, these are the two terms that he selected, you know, and they as the main cause of this declining belief. and the real presence. And again, it was very subtly done. It wasn't something, again, where theologians that the lay people read these books,
sure,
of Sheila Beeks or of Karl Rahner or many others that wrote along that line, that very many priests preached from the pulpit. They didn't use the words transfinalization and transsignification,
right,
but unfortunately, a lot of them were formed, or I might say malformed, in the seminaries with those kinds of ideas.
Okay.
And then they go out, and some of them, and subtly that kind of permeates the whole congregation after a while.
Well, we know, for instance, when I noticed as parish priest, the more and more people stop genuflecting, mm-hmm, when they came into church or when they leave church. Now, to be honest, some of that was because the Blessed Sacrament was removed to a different room and the Blessed Sacrament wasn't present on the altar. But even like a St. Patrick's, where it's right in the middle of the,
yes,
back altar, some people have just become very careless about the old act of worship that we did by bending the knee or genuflecting when we came into the house of God with the red light up there signifying the real presence of Jesus, the light of the world, in that golden tabernacle. So something has happened.
Well, along, I think, with the loss of the sense of sin, as Pope Pius XII, I believe it was, originally discussed this, has been a loss in the reverence, when you go into the church, non-Catholics used to be awed, really, almost by the silence and the how quiet, you know, and mysterious it seemed to be, and this, that, and the other. But that is pretty well gone in most parishes anymore. It's more like a meeting hall. It's an assembly rather than a congregation. And people talk and they whisper and they move around and they visit and they squirm and they chew gum and they do everything, focus on,
sure,
the Blessed Sacrament.
Well, there has been, I know, in many conferences I've been to, they ask us to raise our hands. How many people, how many of you think that we've lost a sense of reverence that we used to have at Mass? And an awful lot of people, including myself, that's one of the things I always, I think the new liturgy and in English is really helpful to us. But I do, in a sense, often miss the sense of mystery or reverence that I think we can restore, but we really have to work on it.
And I think the two things go together, the loss of the sense of sin and the loss of sense of reverence, feed on one another. And I think that they're, people who lose reverence are going to be, I think, more inclined to sin. And
right,
people who have sinned are going to have a tendency to lose, the sense of reverence.
Okay, now, I like your insight about the connection of the two. What would, let's continue with Father Hardin's analysis about how these ideas sifted down into Catholic practice and into our attitudes towards reverence for the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist.
Well, Father believes that these alien ideas, as he refers to them, has caused Catholics to lose their belief in the real presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist, which explains why millions of once professed Catholics no longer genuflect, is what we were talking about, before the Blessed Sacrament. He asked, who would genuflect before a piece of bread? End of quote. Well, of course, that would be idolatry.
Sure. I remember, and I'm sure, and I hope it's a great exception, but a professor in a seminary a few years ago talked about perpetual adoration as cookie worship. Now, I hope that's the only person in the whole Catholic Church who ever said anything like that, but it shows how some of these ideas got disseminated, particularly into highly intelligent people who knew theology But were then kind of swayed away by this subtle differences in the teachings of the church. Well, okay, so what is Father talking about genuflecting? What else would he say has happened to us?
Well, I'd like to quote him again here. Again, this was a part of a speech that he delivered a number of years ago. Quote, 30 years of erroneous teaching about the real presence has deeply affected and infected.
Good term.
Yes.
Infected and affected.
The minds of millions, and I mean that figure, millions of still professed Catholics. Pope John Paul speaks of this dissemination of untruth in seminaries and universities. Holy Father, how right you are. How sadly right you are. This is Father Hardin here.
Quoting John Paul.
Quoting John Paul and agreeing with what he said.
Okay.
Well, that it's infected these seminaries and universities. These ideas have penetrated into the minds of the leaders in the Catholic Church, both among the clergy and among the laity, and among the erroneous ideas I place at root, the teaching about the real presence. Again, this is John, Father Hardin, quoting Pope Paul VI.
Okay, now he goes on, I think, to compare that there's a connection. If we lose the awesome mystery of the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, then it affects other Catholic belief.
Well, in regard to this, Father Hardin concludes his speech that day, quote, believe me, there is much more at stake, much more than meets the eye. Everything in the Catholic faith depends on whether Jesus instituted the Holy Eucharist as the real presence. Why do we say this? Because the real presence implies and includes the teachings that Christ ordained the apostles at the Last Supper. He gave them the priestly power to change bread and wine into his own flesh and blood. So again, that's the end of that quote. And as we discussed during one of our sessions on the Nicene Creed earlier this year, the Eucharist is the source and summit of our faith, and anything that calls into question its efficacy is detrimental to the faith.
Okay. Father Hardin speaks very powerfully and dramatically and very sincerely, I'd say, about here is the heart of the matter that we've got to deal with.
And we have to keep in mind, here's a man that was selected by Pope Paul, John Paul himself, to do everything he could to try to reestablish the belief in the real presence of Jesus Christ and the Blessed Sacrament.
If I may recall, Ron, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed to me that after the Protestant Reformation began, and we all know that the church in the 16th century certainly need to be reformed in its morals, if not in its doctrine, but that's when really different ideas of the Eucharist began to spread throughout all the Protestant Reform faiths. And I recall St. Robert Bellarmine, who was a great champion of the church during the Council of Trent, saying that there were over 200 interpretations to what Jesus meant when he said, this is my body and this is my blood. And the only thing they had in agreement among these 200 interpretations was that it was not what the Catholic Church had traditionally taught about the real presence of Christ. So it's been something we've been dealing with outside the church, but now Father Hardin and the Holy Fathers are saying it's something we're dealing within the Catholic faith.
Well, certainly Martin Luther opened the door. You know, he was a Catholic priest himself, an Augustinian monk, and a professor of theology and scripture scholarship Wittenberg.
Okay.
His idea was of what the Lutheran idea is, consubstantiation, that there is at the words of consecration, there is a transformation. But the transformation is not of the substances. For example, it still remains bread and wine, but that Jesus also, and I think this is pretty correct, also, so to speak, occupies the bread and wine. He's physically present there.
Okay.
It's not just a symbolic presence. Okay. It's a physical presence. So this is why they use the word con, because consubstantiation or co.
With.
So you have both bread and wine, but Christ occupies, so to speak, the bread and wine.
It's about as close as we can get to Catholic belief.
Yes, it's much closer than this transfinalization and
transignification.
Those views are much closer akin to, let's say, maybe a Calvinist belief along that line.
Symbolic belief, remembrance.
But there's a lot of variations on that, as Cardinal Bellarmine quite well pointed out. It wasn't long after the Protestant Reformation, there were over 200 of these different variations on what the real presence meant, what the consecration did or did not do.
From the Last Supper of Jesus.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's move on, since we have a little time, and let's just talk about, very practically now, we've kind of been in theory, but I think it's really important that we talk about it, because thoughts leads to actions, and concepts lead to practices and beliefs. We're coming towards the end of our program, but let's talk a little bit about the fact that since the Church considers the Mass, the old Irish saying is the Mass that matters, it's the core, it's the heart, that the Church has, perhaps since the Middle Ages, put an obligation on attending Mass, that it's such a serious need in our lives to keep one day holy out of seven, that the Church teaches us it's a serious obligation to attend Mass, unless we have a serious reason to be absent, or to keep holy the Lord's Day so the Lord's Day can keep us holy. You want to just say a word about that and we'll get started the next time?
Well, the Church hasn't changed its view at all on the obligation, the Sunday obligation. And as you said, the next session we'll go into major sources where we can find where the Church has not changed its view on this at all. And then when we get through with that, then we'll go into the reasons for this. John Paul gives us those reasons, of course, in his famous encyclical, Deus Domini.
Okay, the Day of the Lord.
The Day of the Lord.
And he wrote shortly before he died.
Yes. There he gives us the theological foundations for the reasons for attending, why we need to keep the Lord's Day holy.
Okay, I think many older Catholics, speaking for myself and generation, were raised very strictly about the obligation to attend a Holy Mass. Boy, you had to have a really, really serious reason to ever miss. Well, I think it was exaggerated myself, but we sure went to Mass on Sunday because you couldn't go on Saturday night then. But I think culturally now, the whole thing has swung the other way, and, oh, you can miss Mass for almost any reason. You don't really have to have a reason. Mm-hmm. So we'll take that up in our next session. And in the meantime, thanks for listening. We're discussing Keep Holy the Lord's Day so the Lord's Day can keep us holy, whole, and wholesome. May God bless you always and in always.